You're listening to a special podcast edition of Talkin' Ball. If you can't watch the show live, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or find it on the CSNW Twitter and Facebook pages after every show.
No, I think that's pretty good. I don't know if you can ever compare football and baseball. Just, I mean, when you play 53 games and win 49, that's unbelievable. It's not really possible. I don't know how they did it.
Pitching.
Well, but Dwight, you weren't going to compare football to baseball, but you were going to maybe compare baseball to basketball, right?
Well, yeah.
Going back a ways.
No, if you go back to the Trailblazers, the year after the championship, they were 50-10. That record on its own isn't that great, but the way they dominated the league was. They totally dominated the league.
And Oregon State at 49-4 is on its way to challenging for the greatest winning percentage, at least in college baseball history. And we'll see how well they can go forward with that mark. They don't have to win all their games the rest of the way to win it all, as we know, with the format as it stands, a double elimination format, when they eventually, assuming they get to the College World Series here in a couple of weeks. The regionals, in the meantime, are built for business, brought to us by Comcast Business Class. It's a four-team regional, as they always are, in Corvallis later this week, and set up, it seems, for success for Oregon State. You should be set up for success when you are the number one overall seed.
Right.
They take on Holy Cross, that is back in this tournament for the first time since 1978. Nebraska and Yale are there as well, as you see things get underway for the Beavers coming up Friday, 8 p.m.
You know, they did get a great draw, I thought. Nebraska is the best other team in this. They've already beaten Nebraska twice this year. It was real early in the season in Arizona. I think, by the way, Nebraska, is it not coached by Darren Ernstad, I think, is the coach at Nebraska.
Well, let's now get a national writer's perspective on where Oregon State fits into this overall equation. Let's dive right in right now with Eric Sorensen from D1Baseball.com. Eric, for those who don't follow baseball as closely as basketball, you say in your writing that the baseball committee might be even worse than basketball.
Dan, that's a great way to crystallize my thoughts exactly. Now, I'm a little bit more harsh when it comes to judging the committee, just because sometimes they seem to get a little lazy at times, it seems like. So yeah, I don't think they're any worse than the basketball committee probably. But basketball seems to have their stuff together a little bit more, because they use an RPI or the baseball committee uses an RPI formula that was originally a basketball formula. So it kind of makes things a little wonky in how to evaluate all the teams. But they try their best.
Oregon State has Holy Cross, Nebraska, and Yale in its regional. They're the number one overall seed, so theoretically that would mean they've got the easiest path to the next round, the super regional. Is that in fact the case?
Yeah, Dan, I promise. My knee-jerk reaction when I looked at the brackets was that Oregon State got a red carpet, especially in the regionals, just because I felt that Nebraska, even though I'm a Nebraska native, I thought they were more of a 3 seed, not a 2 seed. And I saw Yale play this year. They're more of a 4 seed and not a 3 seed. So they kind of got a little fortunate with the layout this first time around. It's not saying that they're going to have an easy time in the super regionals when they make it there, but for the first weekend, I think they're pretty set and shouldn't have too much of a sweat in getting through the field there in Corvallis.
Now, if they make it out of their regional this weekend, they're off to the Super Regional, or they'll host the Super Regional, presumably against Clemson. But you say that that's no guarantee, again, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, Clemson had the misfortune of drawing Vanderbilt as their number two in their regional. And I kind of thought Vanderbilt's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde team, but when they're good, whichever one, Jekyll or Hyde, is good, whenever they're good, they're really good. They're like a number one seed. So I fully expect Clemson to have their hands full with Vanderbilt. They've got some great pitching across the front line for Vanderbilt, that it's a couple of guys that are going to be in the majors in a couple of years. So I think if they get their stuff together and go on a run, I think I could easily see it being Oregon State against Vanderbilt next weekend for the Super Regionals to go to Omaha.
Oregon State, as we know, has the best ERA in the country. Are there certain stat indicators from the regular season that actually carry over when we get to tournament play, or is it baseball and anything goes?
Sometimes it is kind of a crapshoot. We saw that with Oregon State a couple years back when they won their first national title. We saw it with Coastal Carolina last year, kind of came out of nowhere. But I will say this, Dan, it definitely has a lot to do with your pitching and defense this time of year. It's not like the old days when you used to get to Omaha in the Rosenblatt Stadium and you could just bash your way through with the pout with the light wispy bats they used to have. It's definitely about pitching and defense, and about having experience and not a lot of nervousness to your team. And I think that's a couple of things Oregon State really has going for them this year, pitching especially. When you got the top pitching staff in the country with a 1.84 ERA, that's just it's almost a typo to see that for a college team. So that's something that Beaver fans can take comfort in, that it's going to suit them well for the postseason.
Out here, we talk in terms of this Oregon State baseball team being historically the best maybe the program has ever produced, even better perhaps than the back-to-back national title teams from a decade ago. Is that your perspective? And nationally, are they the juggernaut their record suggests that they are?
Yeah, I think it is. Again, I'm using the word typo when you see a team that's 49-4 coming out of the Pac-12 at that to have that good of a record. That's pretty amazing. The odd thing is, Dan, the one time I saw Oregon State play this year, they actually got beat at UCLA. So I think I saw them at their worst. But other than the game I saw, it seems like they just played great all season long. Again, just the pitching is so consistent and so good. And every arm is I give Nate Yeske, the pitching coach at Oregon State, all kind of credit for that. But yeah, I think they're that good. I think people around the country realize that if you only lose four games in a season, especially when you're playing in a Power 5 conference like the Pac-12, you're more than legit. It's the real deal.
So does this team measure up with the juggernauts of yesteryear from the 80s and the 90s?
I think it is that type of team. I'll say this, Dan, the difference probably being when you're comparing it to some of the, like Arizona State, historical good Arizona State teams, they're going to have a lot better offense maybe than Oregon State does, just because the way the bats were at the time and the numbers they put up. But pitching wise, again, I go back to the pitching and just, they're so even keel on defense too. It's definitely a team for the ages. I think they'll stack up with anybody, especially back in the Gorilla Ball days. They'll stack up with anybody as far as pitching goes. Anybody in the country, or anybody that you can historically compare them to.
And we're just excited to get back there. It is very difficult to do.
That's Mike White talking over the weekend as they wrap this thing up with Kentucky. They're now the number 3 seed overall, facing Washington beginning on Thursday. Can we put into better context what Oregon softball has pulled off in a relatively short period of time? Because softball as a sport at the college level is still relatively new. We're talking, well, we're getting old, all of us, but it's not more than 20 years old out there. And,
really?
And to see what Oregon softball much more recently than that is doing, getting to the very top of the game.
Well, Dan, Mike White is a renowned worldwide softball coach. They went out and got one of the best in the world to lead this program, and it's paid off because he can recruit, obviously. They're never short of pitching, and that's obviously what you have to have in softball.
They've definitely established more consistency, than the baseball program has. They came out hot under Horton and then sort of slowed down a little bit, whereas the softball program's rolling. But I'm a little worried about them getting off to a good start in this World Series because they're playing Washington, which beat them 2 out of 3 earlier this season.
Yeah, I hate it when they match up two teams from the same conference in the first round.
Like they played each other already three times.
Part of the problem is all the Pac-12 teams that get in, some of them are going to have to play each other because what do they got? 3 or 4 teams back there in the World Series. It's a softball conference.
Information infused by Eastside Distilling, the College Softball World Series coming your way. 8 teams, double elimination format, as we've come to know on the men's side as well. You see who's at the table, UCLA, Washington from the Pac-12, as well as Oregon. You see right there, 11 titles for the UCLA Bruins. Jeez. Who've been dominant the most all time as they're back there in the field once again. And on down the list, Oregon certainly setting itself up in the, again, relatively early stages of its program now to be one of those teams that can be expected to be there year in and year out. On to football, okay? Sticking with Oregon, but on to football. Vegas has set the over-under for Oregon football victories this fall at 8. They're not going to college football's version of the World Series like the softball team is here coming up this weekend, but they are expected to get back on their feet after a 4-8 season last year. Do you go along with Vegas, and we saw Athlon come out with their preview and expectations, putting Oregon at number 21 in their preseason top 25 and having all these guys on the all Pac-12 team? You buying all this? And you look at the schedule coming up this fall. 8 wins, well, over, under.
My number at the end of last year and during all the controversy with Helfrich being fired was about 8. I said 8, give or take 1. 7 to 9, 8 was my number. So yeah, I'm with it all the way. There was a lot of young talent on the field last year for this team. They got their tails kicked in. They're going to grow from that and learn from that. And I think it's going to pay off this year for a new coaching staff.
Well, here's my thoughts on this. I think you usually look at their preseason schedule and say, well, there's 3 wins. Okay, you only need 5 more. I don't know that there's 3 wins in their preseason schedule this time.
There's 1 guarantee.
Yeah.
The other two are question marks.
The
yes.
other two, I mean, people yeah. don't sleep on Wyoming. You
right.
got to go to Wyoming.
You got to go to Wyoming.
In weather, probably. And they got a quarterback who's going to be a first-round pick, is my understanding.
But I believe fully there are going to be 9 guys starting on offense who will be in the NFL in some capacity, whether it's practice squad or 53-man roster or starters. There's legit talent on that offense. The question mark, though, is the defensive
really?
Side.
No kidding.
What shocker. Newsflash, breaking news only from Aaron Fentress. So it'll be interesting to see what Jim Leavitt at $1.1 million salary can do with this group from last year that was very young, got hammered, lacked some talent, some what they call dudes at some spots. If he can really turn around in 1 year, if he's going to need a couple years to really get things rolling on D.
There are only 2 games you look at the schedule and you say, that's going to be really tough to pick up a win at Stanford, at Washington.
Right.
The rest of them you could see pathways to victory.
They're going to score. They're going to score around 40 points a game. I even told Taggart, if you don't score 40 points a game, you did something wrong because the talent's there. And last year, they scored 39 points a game with a freshman quarterback and a bunch of freshman offensive linemen. So the offense has to score 40 a game. The question is, can the defense not give up 42 a game like it did last year? Can it just give up 30 and then you got your 8 wins?
Can you imagine Taggart going home to his wife and saying, God, this place is going to be tough, honey. I got a newspaper guy or a media
guy
telling me that we're going to score 40 points a game.
They scored 40 last
we
year.
We get 36 a game, we're failures.
You are. They scored 40 last year.
The other part of the schedule, as you might have seen right there, is that they 39. Miss USC and Colorado.
Yeah,
that's the schedule.
Well, yeah, Colorado might take a dip. They lost, I think, 8 or 9 starters on defense, and they lost their defense coordinator. But yeah, missing USC is huge.
Back at the schedule, yeah. And so if you were to add it up, you've got them at 8. Dwight, what do you have them at?
I'll say 7.
7?
Yeah.
So just under. The brawl on Monday. Who is Dwight and who is wrong? Dwight, take it away.
Well, Dwight's right, and they're both wrong. Trust me on this one. This is crazy. Guys are nuts. First of all, Strickland is throwing at him because of home runs hit against him 3 years before that, and the Giants won that series anyway. I mean, you're taking this grudge. This is a team game. Don't make it that personal, okay, pal? And Harper, come on, your team needs you, man. You might lose the pennant by 2 games and you're getting suspended for 4 games. That's dumb. That's really dumb. And you know what? Neither guy comes out ahead from this. They're both, by the way, noted jerks in Major League Baseball. Strickland, his teammates don't like him. Harper, I think his teammates like him because he produces runs, but around the league, not a well-liked player either. These guys just, hey, if you get hit, look at the pitcher, smile, and say, is that all you got? And walk to first base. That's all you have to do.
The best part of that fight is the guy comes out of the Padres dugout to go break it up and ends
not
up.
The Padres.
I'm sorry, who?
Washington Nationals.
Sorry. And just drills one of his own guys trying to get to Harper. That's the best part of it. But I disagree with you. I think Harper's well within his rights to go out there and get some payback on that.
He got suspended 4 games.
Oh, you know what? That's just life. He'll be all right. He might go on a DL for 15 games. Everyone has their star going on a DL for a little bit. What's 4 games? The bottom line is the guy purposely threw a 97.8 mile per hour projectile at your backside.
He at least threw below him. He threw below the waist.
I want to see, I've been waiting for this since I was like 8, a player pick up the ball after he's been hit and charge the mound and throw it back at him and see how they like it.
Hunter Strickland gets 6 games, Bryce Harper 4 games pending.
He shakes his head at me.
Pending the appeal on the matter. All right, let's move on. Unfortunate situation that I don't think has to occur, but for some reason, I think this player brought it upon himself. Mike Trout, the best player in Major League Baseball, is headed to the disabled list for the first time in his career as a result of a thumb injury that was produced from a head-first slide into second base. He's done head-first slides his entire career, and in fact, I was looking up an article dating back to 2014 in the LA Times saying, I've always dove head-first, I'm going to keep doing it no matter what, while he could look around him and see other guys dealing with injuries because they were diving headfirst as well. Josh Hamilton at the time, as well as somebody else there in Major League Baseball. The fact that guys are still diving headfirst in 2017, and now it's going to land Mike Trout on the DL. He could be out for 6 to 8 weeks. Is this ridiculous or just a part of the tradition you got to stick with?
It's ridiculous, Dan. There's no reason for a guy to go headfirst like that. I don't know why. I'm just like you. Why do guys keep doing this when we know it is hazardous to your health? It's really stupid. And as it turns out, he didn't even really need to slide on that play. He was safe. The ball was thrown away. One hop, second base. He goes on the DL just unnecessarily. It's a big loss to baseball. This guy is the most fun player to watch in baseball, bar none, right now.
But he's been doing it his entire career. This is the first time he's got
injured.
That's
no excuse.
I'm just saying, he's had good luck.
But...
Okay.
Yeah.
He's playing the odds.
So you go ahead and speed just because you've gotten away with it so many times before, right? Well,
don't tell anybody. But.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, too, is that it hasn't hurt him in the past, and now it will, and it could eventually knock the Angels out of playoff contention.
No, they are out of playoff contention
well,
anyway.
But even more so. Yeah. It's going to cost them, if you look at the advanced stats, a certain number of wins with him out of the lineup that's going to really...
Now, has it been proven, though, that you get to the base quicker?
No. You mean by diving at first?
No. Straight in is just as fast.
Okay. Yeah. And a lot of times, well, on second base, you want to slide. But, yeah, feet first is just as good as head first.
First time I ever played baseball, I went head first going to second base, and I did it way too early and got huge raspberries on my own. It was bad. Thanks for passing that on.
Thank you for sharing, Aaron Fentress.
Self-deprecation.
Speaking
great
of
moments in Aaron Fentress's baseball career. Moving on.
Assume that it's Damian Lillard number one, or at least 1A, and CJ McCollum 1B. But is there a case to be made that CJ McCollum was the Blazers MVP this season? Anyone whatsoever. And before you answer, let's dive into the Danalytics, the analytics that matter, and show you some numbers that are in his favor. Who has the edge? A couple of categories. 2-point shooting percentage, he's up over Dame. 3-point shooting percentage, he's up over Dame this year. Distance traveled in games, miles traveled, number one in the NBA. No one traveled more miles up and down the floor than CJ McCollum in an NBA uniform this season. And of course, the 2-point percentage is his ranking, number eight overall among players 6'4" or shorter.
Where's the assists and rebounds?
That's where things get a little, you know, dicey.
Just left that out.
Right. Well,
okay.
Well, I'm highlighting areas
selective
in which he excelled. It's everything's selective, right? You got to select something at the end of the day. Those are some of the numbers I selected. So,
Okay. Taking
those into consideration, or anything else you might take into consideration, is there a case to be made for CJ McCollum being this team's MVP?
I'm going to say no because of the analytics you left out, the air analytics we'll call them. The assists and rebounds still favor Lillard. Plus the miles run, I don't even know why that's a thing with you. I mean, is that you're just impressed by that? Is that because he runs around like Reggie Miller to try and get
well,
open?
Well, he's number one in the NBA. So if you're number one in the NBA in something, I'll include it.
Okay, so he's running around to get open a lot.
Yeah.
Who's getting him the ball? Damian Lillard.
A bunch of other guys.
Okay. So that's the difference between a point guard and a two guard in terms of running around a lot. So
well, but he's also a secondary ball handler. He's also
a very a very secondary. But also the shooting percentage is negligible. What are we talking about here? A couple field goals?
Oh, 3-point percentage is not.
Was it three? Well, the 3-point percentage isn't, but the 2-point field goal percentage was barely anything. Yeah.
The 3-point percentage.
He's become a better 3-point shooter. But I think that's partly because Damian takes more bad 3-pointers, I think, than CJ does. He takes some fadeaways, some things maybe he shouldn't take. So I'm going to still go with this being Damian's team, him being the team MVP.
Well, you know, Danny, I think CJ made great strides this year. And you'll recall that story in about the middle of the year that said he's the best shooter in the NBA. And I happen to agree with that. When you look at the shots he makes, the tough shots he makes, from all distances, I really think he is the best shooter in the league right now. And I think he's right there with Damian. I do. I think it's...
Best shooter in the league.
Well, when you take into account his ability from mid-range, and the NBA defense these days, they allow everything They'll try and stop everything but mid-range. And if you can hit down shots at a 50% clip or thereabouts like C.J. McCollum can, then you have a chance at really mucking up attempts the other team has at
he's
trying to defend
efficient.
You.
Very efficient, yeah.
So
all
he's
right.
a better shooter than Stephen Curry now? Is that what we're saying?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
But he's in that realm.
Okay.
For sure with what he's yeah. what he did. And Stephen Curry wasn't the same Stephen Curry this year as he was last year.
Okay.
All right. NBA Finals are almost officially here. Game one tips off on Thursday, and we've had plenty of time for the build-up, but let's distill it down to
Eight
the
months.
Most important storyline of these NBA Finals. Aaron, starting with you.
I'm going to be fascinated to find out where the excuses lay after LeBron loses this championship, because every time he's been eliminated, whether it's by Boston or early in his career when they lost to the Spurs, or he was young that year, or when they lost to Dallas, when he kind of disappeared in that series, or lost to San Antonio in five, there's always some kind of reason for why the supposedly greatest player of all time can only win three titles to this point. So I'll be fascinated to see who catches the blame after they lose this, because clearly it won't be LeBron's fault, because when LeBron's not happy with his teammates, he just leaves and changes city. So we'll see what happens after they lose to Golden State.
All right, mine is Steve Kerr. Can this guy get back or not? They need him. It's his team. It's not Mike Brown's team. And I'm sorry, Mike Brown has proven in a couple other spots he's not necessarily your game coach that you want. This guy right here, Steve Kerr, he can handle them.
Mine will be, can Kevin Durant ever get full credit for his title and or titles that he wins in Golden State over the next few years? He took a gondola to the top of the mountain, didn't hike it himself, and now once he does this, presumably and finish the job, will he get credit, full credit for winning these titles? Or is it do a pull LeBron, go back to OKC, and win at least one more to get full credit for all the titles eventually? That's my major storyline.
He can't get full credit. No
he
way.
Can't ever. Nope. Even if he pulls a LeBron.
Nobody should get full credit.
Well, if he goes,
Right now.
You're one of those guys that wants to judge players by rings. Then when a guy makes a move to go get a ring, oh, he shouldn't do that. But you're only going to judge him by how many rings he wins.
That's not
he ain't
true.
Ever going to win a ring
true.
In Oklahoma City.
That's not true.
All right, yeah. let's
That's
move on.
No.
This conversation will continue into the commercial break. in the meantime, we lost a sports writing legend over the weekend. Yeah. Frank DeFord died at the age of 78, began working at Sports Illustrated shortly after he graduated from Princeton, was there for decades upon decades, also spent a great amount of time, 20-plus years, on HBO with Real Sports, a reporter there, appeared on NPR since the early 80s. Dwight, you had a chance to sit down and have an extended conversation with him several years ago. What are your thoughts on the man?
Well, you know, Dan, this guy was one of the most admired people in our business for his talent, obviously, but also for being such a gentleman, such a man who's made so many contributions to sports and to just overall life in this country. Tremendous fundraiser for charities. He's just an amazing person. And I was pleased just to get to meet him and talk to him a little while. I don't think there's anybody quite like him. I've never read anybody where I put the magazine down and did one of these and say, why couldn't I have written that well?
And he made the
guy could really.
And he made the transition from writing to television. His reports on Real Sports with Brian Gumbel were just phenomenal. Anytime, no matter what topic it was, even something a sport I didn't care about, I would be all over just because he was
most sophisticated guy you'd ever want to see. And he wrote one of the great books I've ever read on roller derby. Nothing was beneath the guy. He was amazing.
Awesome.
The great Frank DeFord. He was 78 years old. We'll be right back.
That'll do it for tonight's Talking Ball podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or find it on the CSNW Twitter and Facebook pages after every show.